If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Augustus, Hadrian, Caligula, Nero, and Marcus Aurelius. Among the roll call of Roman emperors are some of the most feted and reviled figures in history. So it's no surprise that we were overwhelmed with questions for this latest episode in our Everything You Wanted to Know series. Many thanks to everyone who sent one in. Our expert for today's episode is Dr. Sushma Malik of the University of Roehampton. And putting the questions to her was BBC History Magazine editor Rob Attar.
Today, in the latest of our Everything You Wanted to Know podcast series, we're talking about Roman emperors, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sushma Malik, who's an expert on Roman emperors based at the University of Roehampton. She's written a book on the Emperor Nero, which was published last year, and also appeared in our magazine and podcast to talk about him as well. And I'm expecting him to crop up in this discussion too. So, Sushma, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Hi, Rob. I'm really well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's begin with a fairly straightforward question that's one of these internet search queries, and that was, who was the first Roman emperor? And I guess it would also be good to explain why at this point Rome switched to imperial rule.
So the first Roman emperor was Augustus. He was given that name in 27 BC when he became de facto sole ruler of Rome, I think is probably the best way to describe it. In 27 BC, the Senate had a meeting. Augustus handed back all of the extraordinary powers that he had had during the civil war period, which had come just before the time period we generally tend to think of as the fall of the Roman Republic. And then the Senate said, well, no, don't, it's okay, you can have those powers back. And he was able then to go on and establish, over a long period of time, a new system of government, really, in Rome, known as the Principate. So Augustus was our first Roman emperor, and his dates are usually thought of as 27 BC to 14 AD when he died.
And just actually staying on that topic, was it always the plan that he would be succeeded by another emperor? At what point did that become the idea that this would be a dynasty rather than just a one-off?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because it's difficult to, in our sources, really to see that that was a plan from the beginning. I think right from the start of Augustus's principate, we can't necessarily say that dynastic succession was going to be automatic. But certainly from fairly early on, I think Augustus was thinking about who might potentially succeed him. So in the 20s as well, BC, Augustus gets quite ill. And at that stage, there's a bit of an attempt to try and think about what will happen next. And he hands various powers to various people, including Agrippa, his friend and someone who had been quite instrumental in the process of defeating Mark Antony, for example. So there does seem from fairly early on to be some sense that this is going to be the transfer of power rather than, say, at the death of Augustus, that the Roman Senate will take control again.
And then another popular internet search query is how many Roman emperors were there? And I guess here it's going to get a bit complicated because it depends what you define a Roman emperor as.
Yeah, so this is a very complicated question. It's a great question, but hard to answer in a sort of very straightforward number. I have a poster on my office door in Roehampton of the Roman emperors. It's quite a common poster. If you sort of Google search it, you'll see a picture. And that has 72, so I'm going to go with 72 from that. But the reason why it's so difficult, as you rightly say, is because particularly in the 3rd century AD, there were quite a number of usurpers who were claiming to be Roman emperors. They had the backing of their own military, their own armies in various parts of the empire. And they might have been emperor only for a few months or, you know, a few days sometimes. And it depends on how you judge their legitimacy and how we can think about those sorts of questions as well. And then, of course, there's what's known as the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, which is normally dated to the 5th century AD. But of course, in the East, the Eastern Roman Empire becomes the Byzantine Empire, and then you can go all the way down to 1453 and the fall of Constantinople if you would like to. So it's quite a tricky question, but I think I'll stick with 72.
Okay, great. Yeah, it gets very complicated when we start having to go up to the 15th century and factoring
yes.
in all the Byzantine emperors. Okay, so we've had quite a number of questions sent in on a very similar topic. And the first one that I'd like to put to you is this one from Christian Williams on Facebook. And Christian writes, were Roman emperors as outrageously decadent in sex, living, culture, everything, as modern movies and TV would have us believe?
Yeah, that's another great question. My answer is perhaps a little bit sitting on a fence a little bit. Maybe, but probably not, is what I'm going to say. So, of course, as Kristen says very rightly, there's a lot of in popular culture, in TV, in movies. Right, you know, we can trace this back really quite far from the time when, you know, movies started to be created, really. There's a lot of depictions of Roman emperors in particular as enjoying being decadent, you know, having lots of fancy dinner parties, dressing in these amazing ways, having these amazing palaces and generally living in a very sort of in a lifestyle that meant that they were being very, very excessive in everything that they did. And the reason why I say probably not, I mean, I'm not saying that emperors didn't like luxury. They absolutely did, or some of them did, I think. Some of the great stories we get about Nero from writers like Pliny the Elder is about all of the different bits of finery that he collected, the sort of gems that he had. He would sometimes watch performances through a different coloured gem so that he could have different sensory experiences. And that, you know, those stories are absolutely wonderful and the sorts of things, of course, that TV and film are drawing on. But I think we also have to be careful and you know, wary of some of the extent to which these stories go, because luxury is a device with which you criticize politicians, emperors, whomever it might be, in ancient Rome, in Roman history writing, in Roman moral writings, and in oratory as well. So this isn't a new thing of the imperial period of those writers, but actually goes back to the Roman Republic. So one of the ways, for example, that Cicero criticised Mark Antony in his speeches against Mark Antony in the Senate was through his love of luxury. Many things he criticised him for, but that was one of them. And of course, Antony was really one of the prime candidates to be criticised along those grounds because of his association with the East, with Egypt, with Cleopatra. So the idea of luxury and that sort of freedom in lifestyle that we get through the writers, it does have a history in, as a way of criticising and moralising in Roman writing, in Roman thought. And it's also, of course, associated with the idea of monarchy as well. The people who are able to live in these ways need to be monarchs. They, you know, they normally have associations with either wanting to be monarchs or having that sort of monarchical power. And that means that they can really do what they like. And luxury was one of the things that they might do that they could really indulge in. So accusations of excessive luxury like that, I think, is one of the ways that Roman writers in particular it described an emperor as pushing the idea of monarchical freedom that bit too far. So think of Caligula, think of Elagabalus, think of Nero. They really were pushing the boundaries of that idea of absolute power. And luxury was one of the ways to show that.
Now, I mean, two emperors that in particular tend to be highlighted in the regard of like luxury decadence are Nero and Caligula. And so we had a question actually from Arista on Twitter who said, how much of the scandalous stories about emperors like Nero and Caligula are true and how much of it is spin from their enemies?
Yeah, this is another really nice question because it also goes to, a bit like I was saying before, it goes to the idea of the sorts of sources that we're left with from antiquity. And Arista is absolutely right in pointing out the fact that our historical record does have some issues with it because it is, largely speaking, for emperors like Caligula and Nero, it comes from people who wrote quite significantly after their reigns. A generation after in some cases, but often more than that as well, farther removed than that. We do have some contemporary sources from Nero's reign, for example, poetry or other types of writings, but we don't have those histories, those narrative historical accounts. Those come from later, so from the early second century when we talk about Tacitus and Suetonius, or in fact from the late second century and early third century when we talk about Cassius Dio. So those scandalous stories, some of them, this is sort of the perils of being an ancient historian, really. You have to try and make lots of judgments, as Arista is saying here. I am sometimes a little bit sceptical about some of the more scandalous stories that are told, particularly when you wonder, how does a historian, how does a later Roman historian or biographer know about these things? So there's some things that you can kind of think, okay, so that is in an imperial archive, that would be in the records of the Senate, that, you know, is traceable also through material evidence. We can see inscriptions that bear out this, or we can see other sources that are drawing on the same sorts of themes. But there are other times where you think, well, when you hear accounts of the private things that Nero supposedly did in his bedroom with the various people that he married and shouldn't, so the castrated Sporus, for example, you do wonder, how does Suetonius, writing in the early second century, know about this? And of course, it's rumour, isn't it? It's things that other, you know, he'll have read from the time that other people have been talking about. The private antics of emperors, of course, is going to be the gossip around the city. Suetonius also talks about graffiti that's still around in his time that you know, talks about Nero in various different ways. So we sort of look out for those sorts of clues. Is this, you know, something that is backed up by other sources? Is there evidence that can come from an archive or a collection of records from the Senate? Or is this probably more going to be something to do with the gossip going around the city? And we're quite lucky that sometimes the historians tell us that themselves. So, for example, one of the most scandalous stories about Nero is that he apparently sang and played the lyre while Rome burned. So stood watching that event and composing and singing. And Tacitus says, well, you know, that was a rumour. That's what people were talking about. That's what the city was saying that Nero was doing. Actually, you know, he was trying to get people into safety. He opened up his gardens. Tacitus says he was helping out as well. But there were rumours, of course, that spread around that other things happened. And those are based on the idea that Nero probably would quite have liked maybe to be singing at this stage. But actually, he was doing other things, trying to help out. So we do have ways of trying to weigh up the evidence that we find in the sources. Sometimes we're lucky the sources tell us themselves. Other times we have to think, well, how plausible is this? And what is the other evidence that we can bring in to try and analyse this a bit further?
And I suppose still on this similar theme, Jess Dinning on Facebook asked, how was Rome able to survive for so long despite the tumultuous and crazy reigns of the Julio-Claudians? And I suppose we are qualifying that a little bit about how crazy they were, but they certainly were quite eventful.
Yeah, so Rome was, that period of Rome was very eventful. We do have quite a lot going on with these early emperors. Some lasted longer than others. So, for example, Augustus had a very long principate. He was emperor from 27 BC to 14 AD, which is a really good amount of time to consolidate the principate, to get things set up, to establish a lot of customs, to be able to reform the religious calendar, all of these sorts of things, which Julius Caesar had done as well. But we do have emperors who had much shorter reigns. So Caligula was only 4 years, for example, from 37 to 41. But then Claudius and Nero also had, you know, fairly a good amount of time to sort of keep things, set things up and keep things fairly stable, even though it might not seem like it from some of the accounts, but fairly stable during their periods. So Claudius from 41 to 54, and then Nero from 54 to 68. And I think the way that I would answer this question is when we hear about the sorts of things that happened in Rome, the sorts of things that Nero is accused of, that Caligula is accused of, and later on, emperors like Domitian and Commodus and Elagabalus, these are things that they were doing in Rome that were being talked about, that affected the senators, the historic, you know, the people who are writing about those in our histories are sometimes senators themselves. So Tacitus is a senator, Cassius Dio is a senator. And these are then ways of looking at emperors very much from the centre, from Rome. If we widen our view to the empire, actually, you know, whether or not Nero was building the Domus Aurea across various hills in Rome would have been less important to someone in, you know, in the Greek East, in Asia Minor, in these other provinces. Of course, you know, finances was something to think about. But there are also sort of local systems of finances that were in place as well. Of course, provinces had to pay their taxes, but a lot of that management was more local. So really, when we think about the system of the principate, the system of how the Romans, you know, ruled empire, you can have these eclectic figures like Nero, like Caligula, like Domitian, and not necessarily actually threaten the system itself. So it seems like the system was resilient enough to be able to withstand these periods of slightly more chaotic emperors in Rome.
And then I'd be interested in your thoughts on this question from Carmen Ansbro on Facebook, who said, why do we hear more about the earlier emperors such as Nero, Caligula, etc., whereas later emperors like Caracalla, Elagabalus, Severus, Alexander, etc., had some really interesting stuff going on?
Yeah, Carmen's right. They did have some great stuff going on. Elagabalus, in fact, is one of my favourite emperors. I wrote my master's dissertation on Elagabalus. Carmen's right in saying that we do hear, in popular culture at least, much more about those early emperors. And I think part of the reason for that, perhaps, is because our sources are a little bit more reliable for that period. So we have a Roman historian called Tacitus, who is a great historian. He, you know, without his text, we would be certainly much worse off for that period. And he writes about, he actually wrote about emperors right the way up to Domitian, but we don't have much of what he said from the beginning part of Vespasian onwards. So he starts his histories of the emperors, if you like, from the death of Augustus. He says he doesn't need to talk about Augustus because so many people have done it already. Everyone has made up their minds. He's, of course, writing in the early second century, so quite a lot, so later than Augustus. But he's going to start with Tiberius, with the start of the Principate of Tiberius. And then he goes through in his one of his collections, which is called the Annals of Imperial Rome. He goes through to the death of Nero. Unfortunately, the last 2 years of that is missing, so it breaks off for us in AD 66, which is slightly infuriating, but that is what it is. We've also lost quite a lot of his account of the reign of Caligula, which is also very sad. But he did leave us quite a lot in the annals to get our teeth into. And he also writes in another of his historical works called The Histories. He writes about the aftermath of the death of Nero, so the year of the four emperors in AD 68 to 69. And he did go through, as I said, to the reign of Domitian, but actually we only have until the beginning of Vespasian, which is 69 AD. So because we have Tacitus as a source, we have a bit more information to go on. I say that because he really did take into account things like the records of the Senate, daily journals that were being written from Rome to the provinces, those sorts of things, which is brilliant source material. Whereas when we get to the later period, so as Carmen said, emperors like Caracalla, Elagabalus, Severus, Alexander, these are all Severan emperors of the early 3rd century. And these are, for this time period, we have less secure historical narrative, at least. So we have a fragmentary version of the text of Cassius Dio, who was actually writing probably around this same period. So he's contemporary, which is great. He lived under these emperors, but his text is fragmentary. And then we also have another text, which is a collection of biographies known as the Historia Augusta or Augustan History, which are quite difficult to deal with because within the text, it claims to be written by six writers, but it's now been fairly conclusively proven that it's only one. And there are parts of it where it's easy to see that the writer is lying, to be frank, is making things up. So while his he or she, actually, we don't know who wrote it, but while their account of the emperors like Caracalla, Elagabalus and Severus Alexander are a bit more reliable because we've got a few other texts that we can go on as well. And also, sorry, I should say a Greek writer named Herodian too for this period. But we don't have someone quite comparable to Tacitus to be able to get our information from. So that's the source material is a bit of an issue for these later periods. But there's also, I think, something about the first dynasty, the Julio-Claudians, so Nero, Caligula, those other emperors as well, Claudius and Tiberius and Augustus, because it is a really fascinating time for thinking about the system of the government of the Principate. So looking at those emperors allows you to ask questions about how these different characters were negotiating the Principate in this in the earliest period of its existence. So I think historians perhaps gravitate, or I think that's probably true of me as well, gravitate towards this period because it's early, because that's when all of these things were being decided on, and historians were also deciding how they were going to write about it. And that, from my perspective anyway, is really fascinating.
And actually, I suppose on a similar note, we've got a question from Coriander Davis, who asked, which forgotten, less well-known emperors should we all know more about and why?
Oh, this is a great question. So I picked for this one the Emperor Aurelian. So Aurelian was around in the 3rd century, so 270 to 275 AD. And you may have heard of him because he, the Aurelian Wall is still there in Rome. If you go to Rome, you will see the Aurelian Wall around the city. That was one of the boundaries of the city that marked out exactly where that sacred boundary was, that wall, from the 3rd century. So you may have heard of him for his wall. But the reason why I like him or am interested in him is because actually not necessarily anything directly to do with him as such, but because during his reign, 270 to 275, we get a really one of the most interesting, I think, episodes in history that have also includes a woman in it, a woman with considerable power, in fact, in it. And that's because in the period of Aurelian's reign, we see the revolt of Zenobia, the queen of Syria. So she was the queen of Palmyra in Syria, and her husband, who had been king, Odenathus, died. And she was then regent for her 10-year-old son, Verbalathus. And as regent, she had a lot of control over that that region. And at this point, Syria was a buffer state between Rome and Parthia. So Parthia was the empire that was the rival of Rome, that there were constant sort of military interactions between the two, particularly in this period. And at this point in the 3rd century, there was a lot of unrest in the empire, so in particular in the west of the empire. So a lot of the focus of the Roman military was occupied in the west and the north of the empire rather than in the east. So Zenobia takes this as an opportunity to go on campaign and to expand her territory, expand Palmyrene territory. So she conquers actually parts of the Roman province of Arabia, including the city of Bostra, and she also annexes Egypt, which means that these areas were loyal to Palmyra over Rome, or for a short period anyway, a bit loyal to Palmyra. And she's eventually defeated by the Emperor Aurelian and captured and taken back to Rome as a prisoner. And one of the accounts, this is actually from the fairly unreliable Historia Augusta, so it's not necessarily the easiest of sources to deal with, but they do include the idea that actually the idea that Zenobia was this force to be reckoned with. So whether or not this is kind of a statement of clear fact, I think it's probably not, but the sentiment is certainly interesting. And the Historia Augusta talk about the existence of a letter of Aurelian's that basically when he was getting criticism for having brought a woman back as part of his triumph, how can you basically be triumphing over this woman? How could you let it go this far? He writes to the senators, known as the conscript fathers. He writes and says, why are you reproaching me for having performed an unmanly deed in leading Zenobia in triumph? In truth, those very persons who find fault with me would now accord me praise in abundance, did they but know the manner of woman she is, how wise in counsels, how steadfast her plans, how firm towards the soldiers, how generous when necessity calls, and how stern when discipline demands. And that's just a really nice sort of anecdote, if you like, from the Historia Augusta, from history, of an episode where for a short while, a very short while, but for a short while, we get this wonderful character of Zenobia going on campaign against the Romans. And yes, she's taken back as a prisoner of war by Aurelian, but he then, or the historian Augusta then has him praise her for her abilities and for her wisdom and also for her discipline, which is quite a nice episode, I think, from history.
It is, and actually that brings me on to another question that got sent in, one from AgroBiodiverse, who brought up the subject of women's role in this story, and he or she asked, did the wives of emperors have any particular powers?
Yeah, so they didn't have any formal powers, the wives of emperors, whom we call empresses, but that's perhaps a slightly anachronistic term. But they didn't have any formal powers, but they certainly could have honours. So, for example, the title of Augusta. So I talked about the first emperor being called Augustus. Afterwards, that became a title as much as it did his name. Actually, it was a title, a sort of title anyway, for him as well, because it was a title he was given by the Senate. It means the most revered one, something along those lines. So there became a female equivalent of that, Augusta, that imperial women could earn that title if they were and afforded certain sort of, you know, the privileges that came along with being the most august woman, as it were, in Rome, in the empire. So Augusta is one of the titles. Another one is Mater Castrorum, which is Mother of the Camp. And that has a military association, as you might expect. So emperors like Julia Domna, Septimius Severus's wife, was Mater Castrorum. She was Mother of the Camp. She had a relationship, if you like, with the soldiers. She was seen as a maternal figure towards, you know, part of the Roman army. And that, again, it's not a power, but it's an honour, and it's bestowing status. It's bestowing a special kind of status on women, on imperial women, sorry, I should say. On the other side of that, the sort of soft powers, if I can put it like that, that imperial women are accused of having, so this is more of a negative than the honours I mentioned just now, is that historians like Tacitus, for example, Suetonius, are often accusing or indicating that imperial women have too much soft power. They're whispering in the ears of their husbands, telling them to do things that, you know, women want them to do and that they shouldn't be doing. They have far too much of a direct connection to the emperor, in other words. So an example of this that's quite nice that shows this is comes from the emperor, reign of the emperor Claudius. And Tacitus says that the trial of a man named Valerius Asiaticus, who was put on trial by the emperor as part of, for treason, basically, treason trials that were going on in Rome at that time. But the problem was he was put on trial at the request of Claudius's wife Messalina, because the reason Tacitus gives is because Valerius Asiaticus owned the beautiful gardens of Lucullus, and Messalina wanted those gardens. So if he was found guilty, his property would be seized and she would be able to have those gardens, or the imperial, they would go over to the emperor. And he was condemned to death eventually. But the problem is, so there are sort of two levels of the problem here. The first is that Messalina was the one who was pushing this, was pushing Claudius in this direction. But the other is that the first part of the trial was held in Claudius's bedroom rather than in the Senate, because Messalina wanted a sort of closed doors environment in order to get the first part of this trial over and done with. So that was a real a really good example, I think, of how women are accused of having more power than they should by Roman historians, who of course are thinking about this from a very Roman perspective of the evils and the mistrust of women as well.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
if you were to take all of the rumours and insinuations about when, about the Roman emperors who were assassinated, you would come to the conclusion that virtually all of them were assassinated.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And then we had this question that came in from Herodotus, the historian, on Twitter. And they wrote in to say, can you tell us about the Black Roman Emperor? He was fascinating.
Ah, yeah, okay. So this, I think, is someone who's known as the first African emperor. This is Septimius Severus. So we're in the late 2nd century, early 3rd century now. His reign was from 193 to, 211 AD. And this is a period of history, again, where we get a little bit of disruption in terms of the system of government, in terms of the emperors. So as I mentioned briefly before, after Nero's death, there was a period of civil war for a year between AD 68 to 69 until Vespasian eventually set up the dynasty of the Flavians. We get that again with the death of Commodus. So Commodus dies in December in 192. And after that, we get what's known as colloquially known as the Year of the Five Emperors. And the person who wins out from that is Septimius Severus, who then goes on to found his own dynasty, which includes some of those emperors that were mentioned in an earlier question. So Caracalla is his son, and then Elagabalus and Severus Alexander as well. So Septimius Severus is absolutely right. He's a really interesting emperor. He was born in Leptis Magna, which is modern-day Libya. And like I said, he won out of this period of civil war. So that generally means he was quite ruthless, usually in a military context. But he had a good sort of family, a very good family. His father was an equestrian, so part of the non-political elite, I guess is the way to describe that. But he had senatorial cousins, and he had a very prominent wife as well. His wife was Julia Domna, who was from a religious priestly family in Syria. So quite, we've got emperor from Leptis Magna, and his wife is from Syria. And Septimius Severus had a senatorial career himself since about AD 160. And he was governor of provinces, so one in Gaul and then in Sicily and then in Upper Pannonia, which is where he was when he you know, starts the campaign to be emperor, as it were, when Commodus dies. And he had a quite a long reign himself, as I said, for till about till 211, when his when he dies and his two sons take over. But during that reign, he's on campaign quite a lot, and he is the last emperor really to try and expand the Roman Empire. So he established the province of Mesopotamia during his time as emperor as well. And that was sort of the last attempt to do that sort of expansion really before things started to erode a little bit in terms of the maintenance of the empire as we go into the later third century. So when he died, his two sons took over, who were Caracalla and Geta, although Geta didn't last very long because Caracalla killed him. So that's maybe a story for another time. But his wife, as I said, is really fascinating as well, Julia Domna. And it's in fact her side of the family that then, after the death of Caracalla, that's where the next emperors come from. So it's her relatives that are Elagabalus in Syria and Alexander Severus. So Elagabalus is colloquially known as the Syrian emperor, for example. But not only that, she was also a very educated woman, it seems, a literary patron. She had many philosophers as under her patronage. And the literature from this period of time as well is so rich, partly owing to the patronage of Julia Domna. And of course, as I mentioned before, she was mother of the camp as well, so had that string to her bow.
And then coming on to what the actual role of an emperor, we had a question from Altu Onlen on Facebook, and their question was, how much power did a Roman emperor have? How much practical control would they have had?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. So emperors were powerful. I don't think we can necessarily... different emperors had different amounts of interest, I guess, in holding power. One of the criticisms of Nero was that he just lost interest, right? So later on in his reign, he decided, you know, I want to go and perform in Greece. I'm going to go and leave Rome for, you know, a year and a bit, and go and perform and do various things in Greece. And he is, of course, criticised for that, because that's not what an emperor should be doing. An emperor should be at Rome. They should be in this Judeo-Claudian period anyway, unless they're off on military campaign. They should be in Rome, and they should be in charge of things. That's sort of, a big part of their portfolio, as it were. But historians as well tend to talk about their power in relation to their success. So being too dictatorial, as it were, I think that's probably the way to put it in more modern terms, taking too much power and taking too many decisions simply on your own or with bad advice. So Claudius, for example, was well known for taking bad advice. He took in far too much account of the opinions of women and freedmen, according to our sources, and not nearly enough of actual established politicians in Rome. So there's that sort of side of the dictatorial nature, I guess. And then, but against that, there's also the idea that you will just lose interest completely. So, Nero is criticised for that, because actually previously in his principate, he had, you know, been quite involved in the Senate, in passing legislation, in those sorts of activities, which is what an emperor should be doing. So generally speaking, I think it was sort of recognised that the emperor should be very involved in politics, of course, in the running of Rome. The Senate was very involved in the administration of empire. The emperor's administrators were as well, but the Senate too had quite a big role in that. But in terms of being in Rome in the centre, in terms of attending the Senate, someone like Marcus Aurelius, for example, is praised in our sources, because when he is in Rome, and of course he's out on campaign a lot, but when he is in Rome, he makes sure he attends the Senate, and he's very careful to be involved in those sorts of things. But as with all things in life in Roman history, it's a balance. So you want to be taking counsel, you want to be taking advice from good, wise people, such as, you know, established politicians, established senators. So be involved, but make sure that you have the right counsel around you, I think is probably the answer to how an emperor should have, you know, wield their power practically.
And then on the same point, really, Richard Goldstein on Twitter wrote in with this question. Did Roman emperors have staffs? What was the bureaucratic mechanism for instituting their policy decisions across the empire?
Yeah, so this question is related in a way. And so the answer is yes, they did have staff. So things like financial secretaries, correspondence secretaries, often one for Greek and one for Latin, and private secretaries. And they also had, you know, less administrative focused people around them as well. So in their court, they would have had writers, poets, you know, some more than others perhaps, but Augustus is famous for having as one of his close friends and advisors, Maecenas, who was the patron of people like Virgil and Horace. So there was sort of two sides of this, the very administrative side in terms of the secretaries, but also a literary side often as well. Nero, too, of course, had people like Petronius and Lucan in his court. These things changed. What sorts of people held these positions changed a little bit during time as well. So financial secretaries and correspondence secretaries and so forth in the early Julio-Claudian period would have been probably freedmen. So these weren't necessarily at this point particularly prestigious jobs to have. They became so as because of the proximity that they had to the emperor. But in the early period, they were normally occupied by freedmen. But later on, equestrians, so those much more elite members of society were also holding these roles. So, for example, Suetonius probably held one of these roles for Hadrian, the emperor Hadrian. So Suetonius, the biographer, he was an equestrian, probably also held one of these roles. In terms of the administration of empire and that side of the question, as I said before, the senators play quite a big role in this as well, as governors, not of all provinces, but of quite a number of provinces. Egypt, for example, had an equestrian governor usually, but a lot of provinces had senators as their governors, and praetors in particular, which is the magistracy in the Senate, the one below consul, they had quite a big role in empire as well. And we get a great sense of how this worked on a practical level through letters that are sent backwards and forwards between governors and emperors. So the Roman postal system, in other words, and how that facilitated those bureaucratic engagements between the centre and the provinces. So the most famous example of this, of course, is Pliny the Younger, who wrote a series of letters when he was governor of a province called Bithynia in Asia Minor. He wrote backwards and forwards to the Emperor Trajan, asking for advice on certain things. So, you know, this situation has arisen. What should I do? What do you think? Those kinds of questions. We have really good evidence, a brilliant set of letters for. And provincials could also contact the emperor directly as well, petition the emperor. We do have small bits of evidence for that as well. Provincials could send embassies to the emperor if that was something if the issue was big enough. But for smaller things, petitions could come directly to the emperor, who would have time in his day to answer these letters or have his secretaries do it sometimes as well.
Okay, and then we've got a question about the succession of Roman emperors, and a simple one really from Dom Ray on Instagram, and they asked, how did Roman emperors choose their successors?
Yeah, so this is a great question and one that, again, different ways. Depends on what time period you're thinking of, as, you know, what you might be expecting to be the answer. So actually, having said that, usually it was dynastic. Usually it was someone either, ideally, your son, right? Ideally, but Roman fertility didn't always allow that to happen. There were lots of, you know, we have a lot of evidence of Rome, of from ancient Rome, from a social perspective, social history, of the problems that were evident there. Augustus and Livia, for example, did not have any children. They had children with other people, but together they didn't have any children. So often it was difficult for emperors to have their own child as their successor simply because they didn't have any male children. Augustus, of course, is an example of that. So in those cases, you would adopt someone who was a relative in your family, a male relative. So Augustus adopted his stepson, Tiberius, Livia's son from a previous marriage. And then Tiberius adopted Caligula, who was, again, another relation. Caligula died without adopting anyone. He was killed in a conspiracy by the Praetorian Guards. But the Praetorian Guards found in the palace his uncle, actually Caligula's uncle, Claudius, and Claudius is our next emperor. And then Claudius adopts his stepson, Nero, the son of Agrippina, who has become his wife. So we get, even though these emperors would perhaps want their own children, their own sons, to become emperor after them, often they didn't have their own sons, or it didn't quite work out like that. For Claudius, his natural son, Britannicus, wasn't old enough yet, for example, when he died. Then with the Flavians, so that's sort of the Julio-Claudian madness, with the Flavians, it's much more straightforward. Vespasian had two sons and they both became emperor. Vespasian's eldest son, Titus, became emperor when Vespasian died. He was emperor for 2 years. And then after Titus died, his younger brother, Vespasian's younger son, Domitian, became emperor. And, you know, he might not have been successful, but at least the dynastic element was more straightforward. Then after that, we get a period known as the adoptive emperors. So from Nerva in 96 AD through to the death of Commodus in December 192, most of the emperors there are adopted, with the exception of Commodus. So Commodus is the natural son of Marcus Aurelius, but the emperors before him, from Nerva through to Marcus Aurelius, were all adopted. And that's not because of some significant realization necessarily that what happened with the Julio-Claudians and the Flavians wasn't the best way to pick a successor, but rather that these emperors didn't have sons or members of their family necessarily that they were able to choose as successors, so they had to look further afield. So Nerva adopted Trajan, who was a very well-established, I guess, military general at that point. Trajan adopted Hadrian, although there's perhaps a little bit of machinations going on there. When Cassius Dio tells us that story, we're not sure whether the letter of Hadrian's adoption was actually forged by Trajan's wife Plotina, you know, all sorts of implications. And then we get the adoption of Antoninus Pius by Hadrian. And then Antoninus Pius adopts Marcus Aurelius, but Marcus Aurelius is actually also his son-in-law. So Marcus Aurelius is married to Antoninus Pius's daughter. So most of the time it's dynastic. Most of the time.
And there's something you actually alluded to in the last answer when you were talking about Caligula, is a question we had in from Neil or Niall Smiley Oman on Facebook. And he wanted to know how many Roman emperors were assassinated.
Ah, yes. I don't know. Sorry. The answer to this question. So the reason why I say I don't know is because if you were to take all of the rumours and insinuations about the Roman emperors who were assassinated, you would come to the conclusion that virtually all of them were assassinated. There are accusations that Livia might have poisoned Augustus. You know, this comes through I. Claudius, of course, but, you know, there's sort of insinuations you can find in the ancient sources as well. The instance I just talked about with Plotina is another one. So was there something going on? You know, it's insinuated. There's nothing, you know, this isn't historical consensus. One source suggests that perhaps there was something slightly untoward in that succession of power. So if we take all of those as true, then I'm trying to think of an example of an emperor who isn't implicated in some sort of assassination attempt. Nerva, perhaps. He was in his 60s when he became emperor already, so wasn't necessarily expected to last very long. Although there were two assassination attempts or conspiracies during his very short 2 years. There's even occasionally insinuations that Titus may have been involved in the death of his father, Vespasian, although our main sources don't necessarily see that as credible. So it's I would say probably in reality not as many as is insinuated, but if you sort of look down history, it's often almost every other emperor, if not every emperor, has some sort of accusation of foul play going on involved in their death. So quite a few. There was quite a lot of violent death, I think, in those transitions of power often.
So it was quite a dangerous job then to be Roman emperor.
Yeah, I think that's fairly safe to say. Not only in terms of the dynastic succession, but also in terms of in later emperors as well, in particular, in terms of going on campaign, you know, the problems that you have with that. Trajan, for example, probably died of a disease that when he was on campaign. So, you know, Roman life, full stop, was perilous. The mortality rate is high in terms in terms of the ancient Roman world. Being an emperor, of course, there was those dynastic machinations, although you probably maybe had some of that in the Republic with in the later periods as well. But certainly, I think just being a Roman was your life expectancy was shortened by the period in which you lived.
And then another popular internet search query was, what did the Roman emperors wear?
Ah, yes. OK, so clothing. Again, this is a great question because there are different sort of accounts from different emperors as to what they would have worn. The quick answer, if you like, is tunics and togas, that kind of thing. So casual wear would normally be a sort of a tunic, so sort of two pieces of cloth that would be sewn together at the shoulders and then down the sides, that's sort of fairly straightforward. Your toga, of course, if you were doing something more formal. Dress is also a way of showing how an emperor conducts themselves, how ready they are to be, you know, to exercise that power we were talking about earlier. How ready are they to jump into an emergency session of the Senate? Or are they always sort of in their dressing gowns, sort of not quite ready for the day? There are some really nice examples. Suetonius talks about dress in his biographies of the emperors. There's normally a section at the end of his biographies that talk about these sorts of things. And Suetonius, for example, he describes Augustus, so this is a quotation from Suetonius, he says about Augustus, "Except on special occasions, he wore common clothes for the house, made by his sister, his wife, daughter, or granddaughters. His toga were neither close nor full, his purple stripe neither narrow nor broad." So just to put that in context, it would be narrow for an equestrian, it would be broad for a senator. He's sort of positioning himself as somewhere in between. And his shoes somewhat high-soled to make him look taller than he really was. But he always kept shoes and clothing to wear in public ready in his room for sudden and unexpected occasions. So normal sort of, you know, daily clothes, your tunic, that sort of thing, but those spun by his female relatives for around the house, but then, you know, the formal togas as well, which pitched the right sort of compromise between being neither too full nor too close. So a well-fitting toga for Augustus. And we can compare that to Suetonius' account of how Nero dressed. He says, Nero was utterly shameless in the care of his person and in his dress, always having his hair arranged in tiers of curls, and during his trip to Greece, also letting it grow long and hanging down behind. He often appeared in public in a dining robe with a handkerchief bound about his neck, ungirt and unshod. So there's a politics to dress, as you will be, I'm sure, unsurprised to hear when we get accounts of these sorts of things from our sources. So there's a politics of everything, including a politics of dress. Augustus had, you know, clothes homespun and a toga always ready to go at the drop of a hat, whereas Nero was very happy to go around in his dining robe in public.
Great. And a question that I think will appeal to people who've seen the film Gladiator. And that is from John Cartwright on Twitter, who asked, which Roman emperor organised the greatest games in the Colosseum?
Ah, OK. So the person that I always think of when I think of games in the Colosseum and you know, what must have been an absolutely massive spectacle is the Emperor Trajan. And Trajan was a military emperor. He went on campaign quite a lot, and he, including conquering the province of Dacia, what became the Roman province of Dacia. This happened in around 106 AD. And following his conquest of Dacia, once you go on conquest, you are able to gain a lot of money, both through spoils of war in terms of material objects, but also in terms of selling people into slavery. So there was a lot of money that could be made following a conquest. And when emperors got back to Rome, one of the things, of course, that you would want to do is throw spectacular games. And Trajan, through Cassius Dio tells us, threw 123 days of games in the Colosseum in around 106-107. That included 11,000 animals and 10,000 gladiators during that time period. So that, to me, always seems like a good example of probably the most spectacular and long games as well.
And then we've just got a couple more questions. So moving on to the end of the Roman Empire, be interested, I guess... we could do a separate answer for the Eastern Roman Empire, but who was the last Western Roman emperor? And were they in any way responsible for the downfall of that part of the empire?
Okay, so the last Western Roman emperor was is generally said to be a man named Romulus Augustulus. So he had in as part of his name, the first king of Rome and the first emperor of Rome. Augustulus means the little Augustus, so Romulus Augustulus. And this was the time period we're in now is the 5th century AD. And the date for the fall of the Western Roman Empire is usually thought to be 476. 476 AD is the date given to it. However, I should say that that date is arbitrary. It was put back on that time period later. So by a Byzantine historian, in fact, called Marcellinus Comes. There's a great programme on this on the BBC World Services programme, The Forum, on the fall of the Western Roman Empire, where some brilliant academics talk about things like Marcellinus Comes and others. So there is that, and that was very recently recorded. But that date is slightly arbitrary. And generally, when we think about the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, it's not because of a single emperor or because of anything Romulus Augustulus necessarily did or didn't do. Generally, it's thought of, and this is true historically as well as now, thought of in much broader sort of historical trends, I guess, the ideas of causes and consequences. Edward Gibbon, of course, very famously in the 18th century, wrote multiple volumes on the history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And then we also get other philosophers and thinkers. So Montesquieu, for example, in the 18th century as well, writes a shorter piece of work called a study, basically, on the causes and consequences of the decline of the Roman Empire. And generally speaking, this is thought of more in terms of the military strategy of the Romans, the expansion of empire, how big it had gotten, as it were, that actually the Roman success in their military prowess caused their decline because it was very difficult to keep control of that much land, that much territory, especially when you've got invaders coming in from different areas. So historically, that's how it's sort of thought about. Also, of course, Gibbon and Montesquieu made arguments about luxury and decadence. And Gibbon also makes an argument about Christianity as well, the role that Christianity may have played in the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. However, I think more modern scholarship is starting to nuance that a little bit, rightly so, to think about the events of the 5th century, not so much in terms of a straightforward sort of barbarian invasion and fall, but actually look far more at the relationships between the Romans and those people they called and we still call barbarians, those tribes from the north and so forth, who actually had very strong relationships with Romans, you know, served sometimes as auxiliary soldiers in the army, those kinds of things. And actually, it's also possible to see this more in terms of a migratory movement as much as it is anything to do with a decisive fall. So I think that's something to take into account as well.
Great. And just one last question from me, which is, came in from Reek Rark on Instagram, and they asked, who is considered to be the best Roman emperor? And I'd also be interested in whether you share that view of them.
So the best Roman emperor was considered to be, certainly in antiquity, he was given the name the Optimus Princeps, the best of emperors, and that was Trajan. So 98 to 117 AD. And he was thought of as the best of emperors because he was fair and just, and he had, you know, the military side of him, but he was also a very good administrator. He struck that right balance of respect for the Senate, but also taking an interest in things in Rome. He clearly threw these spectacular games, 123 days, what's not to love? Unless, of course, you're an animal or a gladiator, what's, you know, in that circumstance. But he also has a really interesting legacy in terms of this title of Optimus Princeps, of being the best emperor and also being a just emperor. So an emperor who was really fair and administered justice very well. And there's a really nice story that comes through the Christian tradition, which is that Pope Gregory in the late 6th century apparently prayed that Trajan should be taken out of limbo. So because he is pagan, when he died, he is in limbo, he's stuck in limbo, and be allowed to die again, this time as a Christian. So the prayers of Pope Gregory allow for a sort of, resurrection, if you like, of Trajan, who is then able to die again, having recognized and converted to Christianity in this 6th century context. And that then allows Dante, when he writes the Divine Comedy, to allow Trajan into paradise. So he's the best of emperors in antiquity, but he is also, there's a very interesting legacy to that as well. He is thought of also in the Christian tradition in that way, which is really interesting as a part of his reception history. Whether I think he's the best emperor, I'm really interested. Well, as probably my interest in Nero sort of reveals, I'm really interested in some of those emperors who were criticised rather than the ones who were praised. I quite like the Elagabaluses and the Neros who are described as doing weird and wonderful things, and looking at how those acts are, you know, expanded, exploited, manipulated in later periods when we talk and think about those emperors. So I'm not sure I would necessarily say that Nero or Elagabalus is the best of Roman emperors, but I find them fascinating. So for me, they're good.
That was Sushma Malik. Her latest book, The Nero Antichrist, Founding and Fashioning a Paradigm, was published last year by Cambridge University Press. And Sushma will be returning to this podcast in the next few weeks for a more in-depth appraisal of Marcus Aurelius as he reaches his 1,900th birthday. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow when Andrea Pitzer will be sharing a harrowing tale of Arctic survival.